Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. A conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas to improve government effectiveness. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. It's no secret that companies have, for some time, successfully analyzed data to gain a competitive edge. Now that competitive analytics and business intelligence techniques are mainstream, to what extent can government use these techniques to enhance its own performance? We'll explore these and many other aspects with our very special guest, Tom Davenport, Distinguished Professor in Information Technology and Management at Babson College and co-author of Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning. Tom, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure having you.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Analytics is becoming a requirement in almost every industry as companies face increased competition. What are analytics and what are the types of information used in analytics?
Well, I really define analytics as systematic efforts to analyze data in a quantitative fashion. So that might be statistics, econometrics. Sometimes people get into textual analytics, particularly in the intelligence field. Anytime you use systematic analysis of data to help make a decision.
So what are the differences among the other concepts like BI, business intelligence, data mining, analytics, and Six Sigma?
Well, some are kind of subsets of analytics. I think data mining is typically viewed as a subset of analytics. It's one of the things you can do in the analytical context. And analytics is really a subset of business intelligence. So I usually think of business intelligence, that's the broad category in the information technology field for what you do with data to help understand how your organization is performing and kind of what's going on in your business. And it consists of two things. There's reporting, which is simplified reports or queries or dashboards or scorecards. But that's all about the past and it's all about what happened last quarter, last month. And it doesn't really tell you anything about why something happened. And it doesn't go forward into the future at all. Analytics are the other part of business intelligence. That starts to give you an understanding of why something happened, which is always useful. And then once you have a model that predicts the past, you can start predicting the future. And that's incredibly useful. So analytics, I think, is a more valuable activity than reporting, but you kind of need reporting before you can really get into analytics much.
In your recent book, Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning, which you co-authored with Gene Harris, you outlined five stages to becoming an analytic competitor. First, what makes an analytic competitor, and would you describe each stage of the maturity level?
Sure. So analytic competitors are organizations that have really built their strategy around their analytical capabilities. It's how they go to market. It's how they compete. Now, there aren't a huge number of them, but that's kind of the ultimate thing you can do with analytics. The next level down, we call analytical companies or analytical organizations, and they have kind of all the capabilities. They have the data, they have the technology, they have the people that analytical competitors do, but they're just not really that aggressive or competitive about it. Their passion is elsewhere, if you will. The next level down, we call organizations with analytical aspirations. So they kind of get that analytics could transform what they do, but they're not quite there yet. So when I was doing my original research in this area, I talked to, I think, three pharmaceutical companies, and they all foresee a future of personalized medicine, which will be, you know, highly analytical, tailoring drugs to each patient. But they're not quite there yet. You know, we don't have the human genome data at a reasonable price. We don't have any ability to kind of analyze it with your metabolism and so on. Then the next level down, we call localized analytics. And that's kind of the way things have been in a lot of organizations for the last 10 or 15 years or so. It's kind of little pockets here and there, not that important, not that strategic, not really talking to each other across the organization, but they're doing something. And then the lowest level is kind of, I don't know, analytically impaired, challenged, disadvantaged, whatever you want to call it. Either they don't have the data or they don't have any interest in fact-based decision-making for one reason or another.
So you take the stage five, the analytic competitor, and that is obviously, there's a challenge in becoming that stage five analytic competitor. But what about the even greater challenge to remain at stage five, to remain in that stratosphere, if you will? What are some of the other challenges facing organizations who want to remain in that at that level of performance? But why make such a substantive investment to do that?
Sure. Competition based on anything, I think, demands that you keep up your activities. It's rare that you can just kind of coast and not have other people catch up and pass you. If you want to stay a winning analytical competitor, you've got to keep up your investments in data, keep up your investments in new analytics, new algorithms, keep up your investments in how you make decisions on the basis of it. There's a pretty good example in the baseball industry. Many of your listeners may have read this book, Moneyball, which is about the transformation of the baseball industry and really talks about the Oakland A's. The Oakland A's implemented some new analytical approaches involving player performance, really involving how frequently they got on base as opposed to their batting average or whatever. It's kind of on base percentage. They were pioneers in drafting players on that basis, but now everybody drafts players on the basis of on base percentage. So you really need to find some new metrics. So the Red Sox, of which I am a fan, they invest all the time in new metrics and gather new data. They went to the NCAA and gathered data on all the NCAA players so they could start to predict which ones end up, what attributes predict performance at the major league level. You just kind of keep on pressing and keep on pushing.
Private sector organizations have not only leveraged fact-based decision-making, but have also created a sustained competitive advantage. Would you elaborate on some of the successful private sector examples of this use of strategic analytics?
Sure. So there are about 10 or so that I regularly cite. One in the D.C. area is Capital One, which was founded as a highly analytical company. The two founders, Rich Fairbank and Nigel Morris, had this idea of what they called information-based strategy and applied it to credit cards. It's fantastically successful for 10 years. It returned more value to shareholders than any other company in the United States. Now, of course, a lot of other companies use similar approaches, but still a pretty successful bank, even in our tough times for banking institutions. Progressive in the insurance industry pioneered the use of tools like credit score to predict how likely you are to crash your automobile, and it turned out to be a very good predictor. Now they have much more sophisticated pricing. They have millions of different pricing cells based on your driving record and your demographics and so on, as many as 10 times the nearest competitor. There are companies like Harrah's in the gaming industry who've totally transformed themselves around analytics, first for loyalty, then around customer service. Now the kinds of people they hire, they choose very analytically. You have companies in the dot-com space like Amazon, Netflix, Google, that were all founded on the basis of a strong analytical orientation and have really pushed it strongly over the years. You know, Google was really founded on a PageRank algorithm and has now moved into advertising analytics and human resource analytics and website analytics, really all sorts of analytical capabilities.
What are some of the benefits for Google? I mean, I've read and seen some of your videos on your assessment of innovating like Google. It's a little bit different, but I was wondering if you would expand on that.
Well, one advantage is a $550 a share stock price, they basically don't do anything without some data and analysis suggesting that it's worthwhile activity. So if you were, I don't know, an engineer or product manager, and you'd come to them with an idea for a new approach to search or a new approach to applications or whatever, the first question you're going to be asked is, you know, did you try it out? You know, they have 180 million or so customers who are using their software on a day-to-day basis. It's a fantastic sort of test lab for anything they want to do. So it's just built into the culture that you don't try anything, you don't introduce any new product or new function unless you've checked it out and see You know, does it lead to better results? That's probably the key advantage. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why users of search and advertisers have flocked in their direction is they just make sure it's all very effective based on their search algorithms and their advertising algorithms. You know, it works. That's the most powerful advantage.
And so you mentioned the culture and forging a culture. What about the difficulty associated with transforming an organizational culture to forge a strategic orientation towards analytics?
Well, that's probably the single toughest thing. And of course, you know, if your leaders are very gung-ho about analytics, it really makes that cultural transformation a lot easier. You do have some examples of major cultural sort of turnarounds. Harrah's was one where, you know, the gaming industry, let's face it, you know, had somewhat shady origins. The most analytical people didn't flock to that industry, even though it's full of data and numbers. And so Gary Loveman, the CEO of Harrah's, came in. He'd been a professor at Harvard Business School, has a PhD from MIT, and said, and we're going to start hiring more analytical people. We're going to start making more analytical decisions. Ultimately, he said, you know, if you override the analytics for choosing a hotel price or a slot machine profit margin or whatever, you know, I'll fire you. If you don't use a control group, I'll fire you, because it really required that sort of transformation in the culture. And not everybody could make that shift, I think, in an industry where people didn't have that kind of background. But if you don't have that kind of leadership, it's, I think, much harder. And there aren't very many examples. I'm not sure there are any of kind of bottom up cultural transformation. It really requires a lot of help from leadership.
Do you have any insights on how you can convert a leader who may not be an analytic type, if you will, or have that analytic orientation?
Good question. Again, there aren't too many examples, but I think the key is finding what they care about and tilting the analytics in that direction. So just as an example, I'm sure most of you are familiar with this company, Best Buy, big electronics retailer. Brad Anderson, the CEO, was not a terribly analytical guy. He was much more of a bottom-up innovation person. He came up through the stores. He worked in Best Buy stores and really believed in kind of freeing the blue shirts, if you will, to innovate. But some of the people who worked with analytics went to him and said, you know, we can use analytics to really empower the store managers and even the blue shirts to make more decisions at the local level. So they started viewing analytics and certainly portraying them to him as something that were not just a headquarters thing, but something that could be done locally. And that's when he got on board and started to get much more enthusiastic about it. So you just try to find that hot button that your leaders have and say, you know, whatever you want, we can probably use analytics to support it in some way or other.
Very good point. We often hear that the need for IT organizations to scrub their data. How much of a problem is data integrity in any of this effort?
Well, it's a big problem. I was just hearing from a woman who's controller of the Justice Department about their efforts in that regard. And they have six major financial systems at the Department of Justice. Not surprisingly, they often come up with different answers when somebody poses a question. Reconciling them is very difficult. So first, they're going through a very difficult and tedious and expensive project to try to pull together and create one financial system. And a lot of companies have to do that. I think the good news now is that at least in the private sector, most organizations have better data than they ever have before. They have these big enterprise resource planning systems, which provide high quality data, get good data out of point of sale systems and the web and so on. But there's still typically a data integration task to pull it all together. In government organizations, you tend to have a lot of legacy systems, and you may have to do some replacement work, which the DOJ is doing, before you can really do a lot of analytics on it.
How can government use analytics to enhance performance? We will explore this with Tom Davenport, co-author of Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Center report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. What is risk management? How do you manage risk more effectively? How can risk management lead to better decision-making? And what about applying risk management in government? Pick up the Center's report, Managing Risk in Government, An Introduction to Enterprise Risk Management, and find out. This report is especially timely given the Obama administration's focus on accountability and transparency, which has prompted a renewed focus on proper risk management and controls. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and today's conversation is with Tom Davenport, Distinguished Professor in Information Technology and Management at Babson College and co-author of Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning. Tom, government agencies don't compete, but they definitely have a use for strategic analytics. Would you describe how analytics and fact-based decision-making can assist government agencies?
Sure, Michael. There are a lot of opportunities. And I think while government organizations may not be competing on analytics, you're starting to see some evidence that they are beginning to transform themselves through the use of analytics. You see it in certain sectors. Certainly, intelligence has often been about analytics, and they're heavy users of it and have been for a while. The big initiative there is, how do we get different intelligence agencies in the United States to share all that data? Healthcare, huge issue right now. How do we use comparative effectiveness analytics to know which treatment is really most effective and most worth paying for? How do we use analytics to identify the patients who are most likely to contract diabetes, say? Diabetes and congestive heart failure account for only about 30% of the patients in Medicare, but they account for about 75% of the spending. So if we can identify a diabetes patient before they actually contract the disease and head it off through diet and exercise and behavior, you know, that's great for the government and great for the patient. So big initiatives in healthcare. Taxes, I'm afraid, are another area where analytics are pretty heavily used to kind of identify the people who might be underpaying or not paying at all their taxes, and to go after them and to figure out, really, you know, just as with other organizations, tax agencies have to segment their customers, so to speak, and identify the ones who are both most likely to be not paying and those who are most likely to be responsive when you're trying to collect, because you can't go after everybody with equal vigor. And then certainly in the military, there have always been a lot of analytical activities related to supply chain. The Army, in particular, very focused on kind of the human supply chain of how do we attract people to enlist in the first place, and who's most likely to stay with us over time, so we can kind of focus our efforts on keeping the people in who we think have a good chance of doing that. But all sorts of opportunities, I think, but still early days.
Yeah. In your report for the IBM Center for the Business of Government entitled Strategic Use of Analytics in Government, you outlined the Delta model for assessing analytic capability. Would you describe the model and how these traits apply to the public sector?
I think, you know, even if you're just listening to the radio, you can remember this fairly easily. So D is for data. As you suggested earlier, Michael, you got to have good data. And organizations that are really competitive about this tend to think a lot about, well, what might be something new or unique that I don't have already in terms of data that could really help this process? So that might be at Harrah's, it's how frequently do the employees smile at customers. That's apparently a big driver of customer satisfaction. So they measure smile frequency. Postal Service has got a big effort to measure how long it actually takes time in transit to get a package through, and what percentage of the time does it meet their standards. So getting that data is a big first step. E is for enterprise, and we found that when companies compete on analytics, they tend to view analytics as an enterprise, not as a bunch of little localized silos. So that's combining data, that's combining analytical people in many cases, and also combining, you know, technology and technology solutions. L in the Delta model is for leadership, probably the single most important thing. So, you know, if you've got somebody leading the charge, you'll do very well. In government, I think the best example of that is when Dr. Ken Kaiser was head of the VA, really led the charge on putting electronic medical records in place and starting to do things like disease management and so on with that data. T is for target. So where's your focus? For the VA, it's probably going to be on something involving patient care. For the Postal Service, it's probably going to be around something related to logistics as a primary target, because that's where you spend all your money and that's what creates your performance. For a private sector organization like a Harrah's, it's on customer loyalty. So eventually, analytical orientations can kind of spread out into a variety of areas, but you need to start with a target. And then finally, A is for analysts. If you want to be highly analytical, you need to either have some internal capabilities, or you need to find them somehow. You know, maybe consultants or contractors can help in that regard, but you need some people who are able to think analytically, who can do the data analysis for you, and even more important, who can communicate effectively with decision makers about what the numbers say. So one of my research organizations calls that, you know, PhDs with personality. It's great to have the math skills, but you also need to be able to communicate and build trust among decision makers.
Now, you mentioned earlier the use of strategic analytics in healthcare. And I was hoping you could drill down a little more in terms of where do you see it being used most effectively? Evidence-based medicine, disease management, and even with Medicaid, Medicare fraud?
Yeah. Well, it's happening in all of those areas. I think certainly for, you know, to make healthcare reform really work, we're going to have to, you know, not just insure more people and make it possible to get health insurance even if you have a pre-existing condition, but we're going to have to get better at how we actually provide healthcare. And analytics are often the key to that. You have some private healthcare institutions like Intermountain Healthcare in Utah, Partners Healthcare in my neck of the woods in Boston, that have done some great work at embedding evidence-based medicine into actual day-to-day practice. So at Partners, for example, they have a semi-automated system that has care protocols that have been, you know, validated through statistics and research that, you know, if a patient comes in with a certain set of conditions, the system is going to recommend that the physician give a certain drug or follow a certain care protocol. Now, the physician can override, and that's pretty important, I think, in medicine, because physician may know something that the system doesn't. But increasingly, we're going to do evidence-based medicine and not leave it up to humans to remember all of that, but embed it into systems. And that's what the VA did early on with their electronic medical record system. And increasingly, the leading private healthcare institutions are doing the same thing. Still a small percentage, but that's definitely the direction that it's going. In Medicare and Medicaid, the focus is, as you suggested, disease management to identify the really expensive cases that we might be able to head off a little bit, or at least treat more effectively, and then to identify fraud. Obviously, Medicaid is going to be done at the state level, since that's how it's administered. Medicare is going to be done more at the federal level, and a lot of activity, obviously much more fragmented for Medicaid, but a lot of activity in both cases to eliminate fraud for people who, you know, file claims or whatever that don't really deserve to be paid back for them.
You had mentioned also government revenue management. Would you drill down a little bit on that one, too, and explain to us where it could be used effectively?
Sure. So the general feeling is that there's this phenomenon called the tax gap, which is the gap between what we should be paying and what we're actually paying. And most people tend to believe it's about 15%. So obviously, that leads to a pretty big number if you can increase that through analytics. And so the IRS, for a number of years, actually a couple of decades, has been identifying people who are not paying what they probably should be paying based on what other factors we know about them. It's called the Taxpayer Compliance Measurement Program. It probably could be a little bit more aggressive. I think the payoffs from doing analytical work in revenue management tend to be huge, roughly tenfold. So If I were a congressman, I would send money to the IRS to do analytical work because it really pays off in a big way. Sweden is probably, of all the tax authorities around the world, is probably the most aggressive one we found at using analytics to not only identify people who don't pay enough, but really to kind of build confidence in the tax authorities that, you know, the rules make sense and that people are encouraged to perform the right behaviors as far as their taxes are concerned. A lot of tax problems are errors, not criminal intent. And I guess a big part of that confidence in the tax agency is confidence that they'll get you if you don't pay what you're supposed to. But they've really built their strategy around it. And as far as we can tell, are the most aggressive revenue management agency. A lot of state work in that regard, too, in the United States. Massachusetts, my state, unfortunately, is they haven't come after me yet, but someday they probably will. Really big on using analytics. Texas is another one. So a lot of, you know, isolated efforts at the states in that regard.
Well, what's interesting is you mentioned Sweden as an example. Are there other international examples where strategic analytics are happening more effectively in the government realm that maybe the governments, local, state, municipal governments in the United States could emulate?
Well, most of our research for the Center for the Business of Government was about the U.S. This Swedish one stuck out. My co-author on this project was Finnish, so maybe she was a little bit more oriented to Scandinavia. But certainly in healthcare, the analytical activities are taking place all throughout the globe. It really, you can look at how likely analytics are. Single best driver is how long ago did they put in an electronic medical record system. So Canada had one a while ago, and they are into analytics in a fairly substantial way in healthcare. The British system, despite being nationalized, does not have a common electronic medical record system. And so, you know, they don't have good data yet. There's some other areas. Canada has done some really interesting work in the fire prevention area. I'm told there are a lot of trees up in Canada, and they own a lot of public land that's forested. And so hard to fight fires in all of those areas equally well. So they use a big geographical database and some predictive analytics to say, where are the fires most likely to occur? And they pre-position firefighting resources in those areas so that they can be ready to fight them. And they say it's saved thousands of hectares of forest land in that fashion. The other area, of course, is in crime prevention, and that's happening around the world as well, a little bit more at the local level than the federal level in the U.S. So New York City.
Comstat.
Yeah, with Comstat and the real-time crime center that IBM runs for them. Mostly reporting-oriented, but still, you know, very much data-oriented, and I was reading some numbers last night. Since Comstat, major crime in New York City is down 74%. So it's really a dramatic story. Probably some other factors going on like demographics and so on, but you got to be impressed by the results there.
And at least you understand the data is there.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I think the other thing that's key is a lot of different police departments around the country have adopted Comstat, some with much less success. What I think made it work in New York City and in any place where Bill Bratton, who implemented it there, he moved on to Los Angeles and recently retired from there, you know, he engaged the whole police force in it. So everybody had to come to Comstat meetings. Everybody is being asked questions about, you know, what's in your data and why haven't you responded to it and so on. So kind of that leader putting on the organizational pressure helps a huge amount.
So, Tom, from your research, what advice would you have for government agencies in order to get to where they need to be in order to leverage the right amount of analytics?
Well, if you look at the Delta model, Michael, I think the D is not a problem. There's plenty of data in many agencies, and it may have to be some remedial work, but there's enough to work on, I suspect. The E is an issue in government because we tend to be pretty fragmented in most agencies. The analytical people aren't talking to each other. You know, in the intelligence community, they're working on that, and having a Directorate of National Intelligence, one of the things they're trying to do is to share more information and be more enterprise-oriented with regard to analytics, but I think still a long way to go. The L word is probably the biggest problem. problem in that we don't have enough highly analytical leaders in government who are able to really press for this and devote the resources to it and so on. So I'm hoping that somehow they will emerge fairly soon. Targets thing is not that tough. I think for most government agencies, they can figure out, you know, where are the most fruitful targets. I was talking to some of the people in the Social Security Administration, and for them, you know, one of the initial targets for analytics was giving people who are disabled benefits as soon as possible, you know, really speeding that process along. So, you know, that's a natural result for an organization that's really, you know, trying to help its constituents. Finally, the A word for analysts. In a way, it's a problem because there aren't that many in government. Less of a problem because you can fairly easily procure them externally. A number of the Medicaid fraud organizations go outside and work with contractors on that. But I think the key in government, particularly in the intelligence sector, is we call people analysts who aren't very analytical. There have been a couple of studies recently suggesting that, you know, in the CIA and the NSA and so on, the analysts tend to rely more on intuition and experience more than analytics, despite the fact that, you know, we have a vast amount of data that's being analyzed at places like the NSA. I'm not sure that enough of that serious analytical work actually gets used in analyst reports and even less so in policymaker decision making. So at the start of the funnel, we do really well. At the end of the funnel, where it comes to analysts and decision makers, not so well with our analytical orientation in government.
What about making better decisions? We will explore this with Tom Davenport, co-author of Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The term cloud computing is suddenly everywhere, with government leaders, industry executives, and the press all talking excitedly about this new concept. Moving to the Cloud, an Introduction to Cloud Computing in Government by David Wild, examines both the interest in and the technology surrounding cloud computing, and why it is receiving such increased attention. It tackles such questions as, what is cloud computing? What are some of the top challenges facing government leaders pursuing cloud computing strategies? You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. As society has become increasingly dependent on information technology in government, business, and in our personal lives, safeguarding private information created or shared on computers or the internet has taken on greater significance. How do you keep information secure in an increasingly interconnected and networked world? What is cybersecurity? Pick up the latest Center report, Cybersecurity Management in States, and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and today's conversation is with Tom Davenport, Distinguished Professor in Information Technology and Management at Babson College and co-author of Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning. Professor Davenport, in a November 2009 Harvard Business Review article entitled Make Better Decisions, you note that in recent years, decision makers in both the public and private sectors have made a number of bad calls. Would you tell us more about this apparent decision-making disorder? And what about the need to formalize decision alternative mechanisms?
Sure. You know, I was thinking about this recently. I teach a course at Babson to MBA students on decision-making. And one of the cases we looked at was the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. And then we try to talk about the invasion of Iraq as well. You know, I had them watch the movie W, which is, you know, we don't have great data on what decision processes were used, but it's all kind of depressing in a way, because we seem to use a bad decision-making process in 1961, and we seem to use a bad decision-making process 45 years later with regard to Iraq. And so government has not cornered the market on bad decisions. As we know from the financial crisis, a lot of really bad decision making in that regard. So my hope in that article and my work on decision making was to get people to think about, if we're making all these bad decisions, maybe we should start taking a systematic look at how we do decision making. One of the other somewhat depressing thoughts is I went back and looked at when did the idea of groupthink get first identified by an academic? And it's about 50 years ago or so. Yet I don't think we've necessarily gotten any better in avoiding groupthink. We have all these ideas, these learnings about decision processes, but they don't really make it into the decision-making processes of many organizations. And so I've been trying to go a little bit beyond analytics and saying, okay, you know, maybe you have some analytics, maybe you don't, but how do you really systematically improve how you make decisions? And I think it should work in both public and private sectors.
Many organizations continually re-engineer their business processes. Why do you see few organizations re-engineering their decision-making capability?
I think there are a variety of reasons. One, we've typically viewed decision-making as the province of senior executives. You know, George W. Bush said, I'm the decider, and, you know, that's kind of my bailiwick, and stay out of it. And I think there's been that implicit kind of assumption for a lot of other people. There are a lot of new approaches to decision-making that may not have been digested. The whole idea of behavioral economics, which is just making its way into the public sector now. You have Cass Sunstein as the czar of regulation now, who has written a book about this subject called Nudge. But it's still early. I think analytics are not well known to many people. What some of the things we're learning from neuroscience, I think, are not widely known about the role of emotion in decision making, for example, intuition versus analysis kind of distinction. So a lot of new content that may not have been digested yet. Anyway, that's what I'm hoping.
Well, you outline a framework in the article for improving decision making. Would you elaborate on that framework?
Sure. So it's a 4I framework. It's not like Delta. It's not an acronym. But the first I is really to identify what are your key decisions. I mean, when I go around and talk to organizations, I say, you know, do you know what your top 10 or top 15 or top 20 decisions are? And very few do. And, you know, I think we can't make all of them better. So we should identify which ones, both a strategic perspective and an operational perspective, which ones are really critical to our effective performance. So then for those, you start taking a look at them, and I call that the inventory stage. So how well are they made today on average? How long do they take? Who's involved in them? You know, get a sense of how broken they are, how much opportunity there is for improvement, if you will. And then the third stage is to intervene in them. And maybe the difficult thing these days is there are a lot of possible interventions that most organizations haven't taken advantage of. You know, one being if we're going to do a lot of that particular decision, we can automate it to some degree. So that's one of the things that the Social Security Administration is doing with regard to disability claims. If it seems like a clear, open and shut case that a person has a disability and we want to get it through the system very quickly, might as well make that decision in an automated or at least a semi-automated fashion so you can get it done. I think IBM has been working with them on that particular project. Another would be just to think about who's involved in the decision and should it be a little bit broader. One of the things the Obama administration is trying to do is to get more, you know, public input into decision making. Another would be thinking about, you know, the mix of emotion and intuition and rationality in it. So there's some decisions like moral decisions that emotion seems to be absolutely essential to. If people lose the emotional part of their brain, they can't make those decisions at all, whereas other decisions for which there's data available and for which, you know, the stakes are high really probably should not be purely intuition-based. So the intervention step is really stepping back and saying, what can we do to make this decision better? And then finally, there's an institutionalization process to say, okay, if we really care about making decisions better, what are the things we can put in place, like a set of decision analysts or coaches, like a process for looking back at how decisions turn out that could really make us get better at this over the long run.
So are there organizations that have employed better decision or overhauled the decision-making process that you would like to elaborate on?
There are. I mean, I've certainly been able to find people who have done at least one of those steps. In the article, I talk about Stanley Works, which you're probably all familiar with. You know, they make hammers and rakes and tools and so on. And they certainly did the identification step. They identified pricing as a really key factor. It's true for almost any private sector firm, but most haven't really done a systematic analysis of pricing. They looked at how the process of pricing worked so far. Their interventions were really multifaceted. I think that's one of the keys. So they established a pricing center of excellence. They put in some pricing optimization software. They hired some contractors to get competitor pricing. They put in some meetings where different parts of the company would share how their pricing was going. And fantastically successful. Over 6 years, they improved their gross margin, their profit margins by 6%, which is really huge. And, you know, maybe that's why they were able to buy Black & Decker, which we learned about a few weeks ago, because they've just been really successful at doing this. So they're an example of an organization that really went through all of those stages, and they even have institutionalized it by continuing to get better, looking at their pricing successes and failures. They have the Pricing Center of Excellence kind of shares knowledge around the organization of what different groups are doing. So, I think very successful. Chevron, sound like a fair amount of money, but every decision over $100 million in their oil business has to go through a regular decision analysis, has to be looked at afterwards to see how did it work out in a kind of a non-recriminatory atmosphere. So not as many probably in the public sector, although the Army was really good for a while at learning from its experience and kind of doing look-backs, if you will, at key initiatives in the field to see, you know, what might we have done better. So there are aspects of it that have been done in the public sector as well.
In the new landscape of decision-making, ancient approaches have recently been augmented by improvements in technology and new research. Would you briefly outline these approaches and describe the strengths and weaknesses of each?
Sure. I have a chart in that article, which I can remember some of anyway. So there is that old favorite, intuition. And intuition, it turns out, is very helpful under a couple of circumstances. One, when you can't use any other approach. Two, when it's really doesn't matter that much. You're trying to decide what kind of ice cream to get. You probably don't need a regression equation. And three, when you have a lot of experience. So I recently debated Malcolm Gladwell, who wrote this book, Blink, about, I think, kind of glorifying intuition, although he argued that it didn't. But he said he's really talking about cases where people have a lot of experience, and then it can be a very useful guide. It's almost like you've internalized that quantitative analysis in a way. Then there are analytics, which are great if you can get the data, if you can take the time. It's usually a somewhat time-consuming exercise to develop an analytical model, and you find that when you do that, the decisions tend to be better and more accurate if you use analytics. I mentioned behavioral economics before. I think we're just starting to think about that. Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein in their book have a concept they call choice architecture, which says that, you know, there are certain decisions that we make that are going to be influenced by somebody. Their example is if you're a kid at school going through the cafeteria line, and you're the cafeteria manager, should you put the apples in the most prominent position or the cookies? Now, the cookies are probably going to get picked up anyway, to some degree, by the kids. You might as well put the apples in the most prominent position because something has to be there. So they use a lot of examples. Behavioral economics research is suggesting that in 401k programs, if you just make people opt out instead of opt in, you get a lot higher participation. So that's kind of the idea of behavioral economics and choice architecture. In neuroscience, I think we're learning that there are certain types of decisions that we typically make well, but others we don't make well. Complex financial decisions, our brains are not quite up to the task, it seems. And that probably has something to do with the fact that, you know, we took all these subprime mortgages and didn't really calculate that they were going to come back to bite us in the rear, you know, when the low introductory rate ran out. Our brains are not good at that kind of decision. And so we really shouldn't entrust it just to our brains. And we would hope that policymakers would kind of protect us from ourselves in that regard.
Well, actually, that's a good point, because you do mention the decisions to invest in securitized subprime mortgages and hedge risk with credit default swaps. To what extent were those decisions less about properly using analytics and more about the ethical and fiduciary behavior of those actors?
Well, I think it's probably some of both. I'm sure, and I've read a fair amount about this, that there was some belief that people were not going to be able to pay these loans back. And so it's kind of a short-sighted decision, at least, if not immoral, to make all these kinds of loans. People were compensated for making them anyway, which is unfortunate. But I think the analytics, it's not that the analytics were wrong, but they were not properly used in a lot of cases. It's kind of the thing about analytics and predictive models in particular is they're mostly based on the past. If you think that the past will be a good guide to the future, then analytics are great. If you think there's something changing in the world that makes the past not a very good guide to the future anymore, then you need to really change your analytical models. And so what happened, particularly in the housing space, is that what had been true for the last couple of decades stopped being true around 2007 or so, and most organizations didn't realize it quickly enough to adapt and didn't have the assumptions written down in their models that said this only works when housing prices go up. In fact, there were some models that would not take a negative value for housing price over time. It's just increases were part of the natural order of things, it was assumed, and they couldn't really put in anything else. So that's clearly not a good model.
How do you balance and augment decision tools like modeling with human intuition and judgment?
Well, that's a real interest of mine. And I think there are some things that analytics are really good at, but there's some things that humans are really good at. And analytics are not really good at knowing when they don't apply anymore. And computers obviously are doing that work, and they are not going to give you a recommendation. Please turn me off. You know, the conditions no longer prevail that I can make a decision well here. So humans are good at that kind of big picture thinking and kind of noticing changes in the environment. And so we should use our brains for that kind of purpose. There's an airline pilot who's a friend of mine who I sometimes go sailing with. And he was one day telling me, we were talking about analytics, and he said, oh, yeah, we have plenty of analytics in the airline business these days. We have green screens, we call them, and avionics and fly-by-wire systems and so on. But he said, I still find it useful to look out the window every now and then. And so I think that's really what we have to do. We have to, you know, keep our eye on the computers and the instruments and so on, but also look out the window to say, is there really something happening here that makes these analytical tools not as useful as they might be? Is there a black swan coming up, as Nassim Taleb calls it? You know, I think most swans are white, and so analytics in that sense, normal statistical distributions can be pretty useful, but there's sometimes when a normal distribution doesn't apply, and you need to have your eye out for those all the time.
What does the future hold for the use of strategic analytics? We will explore this area with Tom Davenport, co-author of Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Management of government projects, programs, and portfolios, and the related expenditures of public funds are major visible areas of interest and concern. Despite a growing stream of successful program and projects, failures continue at an alarming rate. Pick up the latest Center report, Project Management in Government, An Introduction to Earned Value Management, and find out how this powerful methodology can make your projects more successful. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. Whether it's the federal government's role in emergency management, its efforts in making operations more sustainable, responsible, and efficient, or the challenges being faced and innovations being forged by local governments during difficult economic times, the spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine offers timely, relevant, and thoughtful perspectives on all of these issues from leading practitioners and public managers. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine, and we know it's all about making connections, introducing our readers and connecting them to the work of government executives who are leading agencies or initiatives that are focused on critical missions, missions important to them. In our latest edition of the Spring 2010 Business of Government magazine, we bring you conversations with FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate, who talks to us about the challenges facing his agency. Michelle Moore, Federal Environmental Executive, outlines sustainability efforts in greening federal operations. And Robert Doerr, Commissioner of the New York City Human Resources Administration, sheds light on how his agency is doing more with less. Our forum is dedicated to exploring ways government leaders and all leaders can make better decisions. All of this and so much more in the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and today's conversation is with Tom Davenport, Distinguished Professor in Information Technology and Management at Babson College and co-author of Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning. Tom, what about next steps in implementing analytics in the government sector?
Well, I think there will be even more appetite for this going forward. If I were primarily focused on government, I think what I would try to do is develop some capability to educate senior policy makers on the value of this kind of approach and what their responsibilities are. I mean, this is not just something that the analysts can do by themselves. Executives need to ask the right questions, need to kind of push back when they don't understand something. That was another problem, by the way, in the financial crisis, is you had executives buying into models that they didn't really understand. And so, when things went south, they didn't know what to do about it. So I think in areas that we know are going to be big over the next several years, like healthcare, identifying what are some of the key analytical approaches that make sense, what are the key analytical targets, what should the government really be enforcing. One of the things that's happening in the health IT space is that you're going to get money for doing an electronic medical record if you're a hospital or a physician's office. But part of what they're calling meaningful use of those technologies is thinking about using analytics as well. How do you use the data to make better decisions about healthcare? So that, I think, is definitely going to be shaping some of the thinking in the government space. If I were in intelligence, I'd be focusing on getting the analysts to be more analytical and using some of that vast stream of data. So it differs by target area and, different kinds of agencies and so on. But I think one of the great things about the Obama administration is they seem to care about data, transparency, evidence-based decision-making and so on. Whether they will ultimately make better decisions, who knows? But I at least like some of the processes that they are following.
So throughout our conversation, you've mentioned the importance of leadership in making this successful. You dedicate a full chapter, as I understand it, in Competing Analytics to an analytical people and how you craft that. Would you tell us or identify some of the successful characteristics of a CEO who actually gets it?
Sure. Well, as I say, there aren't that many examples of midnight conversions. All of a sudden I wake up and I realize I should have been using analytics all these years. The successful CEOs tend to be people who were analytical all along and they just made it to CEO, or they were viewed as being somebody who could bring this orientation in. The guys at Capital One were analytically oriented consultants before they started the company. As I mentioned, Gary Loveman at Harrah's was a business school professor and used analytics in his work. So the good news is that more and more people have been trained in this in schools. And so, many of them forgot about it by the time they got up to be near the CEO level. But it's not that hard. You just need to ask questions about, you know, what are the assumptions behind this model? Are there any circumstances under which it doesn't work? Basically, as Gary Loveman says, you have to push back and ask occasionally obnoxious questions about, you know, where's the data? What's your source of evidence for this? Should we go gather some more data? And, you know, what do the data suggest? And do you think that we have a, you know, framed the decision in the right way in the first place? That's part of the job, is just framing the question right in the first place and examining lots of alternatives.
So we talk a lot about collaboration. How can strategic analytics assist companies or organizations to better collaborate?
Well, that's one of my hobby horses, actually. I don't know if you knew that. I haven't written much about it yet. But my view is that we can get data on collaboration if we really want it. Most of the tools, you know, Lotus Notes, certainly, and many of the other tools that people have for collaboration, they sort